Well, good morning and welcome. And I always have to wait until I see myself on the screen. So good morning to those at home at Crossroads, Highland Park, Vernon Hills, the 01. So Jonah, Exodus, the book of Ruth, book of Esther, the prodigal son, the good Samaritan, Elijah at Mount Carmel, Jesus in the temple. There are all kinds of stories in the Bible. And we are going to begin, this is week one in this 9-week series called This Is My Story, in which we are looking at stories. You just heard Jay's story. Jay and his wife Lindsay are at the Crossroads campus. And so you just heard his story, and every week we're going to relate a story from someone within the congregation. But additionally, we're then looking at biblical characters to see, in both cases, individuals and the people that are part of this local congregation and also people that are in the Bible, to look at how they have walked through life, to look at some of the inflection points, to look at how they've tried to figure out meaning, figure out what matters, figure out what's going on, figure out how they might connect with God and move forward. So that is sort of driving this whole thing. Our hope is that we will, in some cases, be informed and inspired about what we could do. Perhaps in other cases, we will be informed and warned about what we should not do, but we can better understand our place in this, in relationship to God and relationship to life and meaning. And so This Is My Story is the series that we're going to begin. Now, before we begin this series, I feel this compulsion to correct any of you that think that the Bible is a collection of stories, that it's this, anthology, it's some amalgamation of inspirational stories or religious lessons or things like that. I've suggested as much by saying, wow, Jonah, Book of Ruth, Book of Esther, Jesus in the temple. Yes, there are stories in the Bible, but we're off when we think of the Bible as a collection of stories, as opposed to a big story, a grand story. It is the story. It is God's story. And it is a story that begins in the beginning, and it ends all the way 2,500 pages later with this vision of a new heaven and a new earth and a new Jerusalem. And we have to understand our story in the context of the big story. We have to understand how we are a small part of God's overarching, unfolding plan. There is a universal meta-narrative. Now, if you've been to college lately, or if you pay attention to these kinds of things, you know that those are sort of fighting words. What we hear over and over is that there is no meta-narrative. There is no absolute reality. There is no universal truth. You have your truth. I have my truth. We all have our own stories. We get to define who we are. We get to define our reality. So the idea that I'm saying that there is a universal meta-narrative, these are fighting words. Again, the big story of the last, certainly to some extent since the Enlightenment, but in particular in the last 10 years, the big story is that there is no big story. Right, people are absolutely certain that you cannot be certain, right? And so I'm being a little snarky here. There's a little bit more to it than that, but I want to say the claim that we find here is that there is universal truth. There is ultimate reality. There is a God who defines things, and we operate in his universe. We can't expect him to validate ours. So, to that end, we're looking at individual stories and placing them in the context of the big story of God creating, us rebelling, God rescuing. Today, we're looking at the character of Gideon. So Gideon is a not particularly impressive guy, as you will see, but he manages to land a spot in the Hall of Faith. Hebrews chapter 11 is this, you know, the Hall of Fame of Faith. You get a plaque in Cooperstown or Canton or whatever sporting Hall of Fame you want to think of. He manages to find his name on that list. And it's worth noting how. So the book of, or the story of Gideon, it unfolds in the book of Judges. So Judges is the book that follows Joshua, which I sort of think doesn't help you as much as it might need to. So we start with Genesis, and the first 11 chapters of Genesis is universal history, right? Creation, fall, flood, all that stuff. And then Genesis 12, God calls Abraham. And he forms a covenant with Abraham. And from Genesis 12 all the way through the entire rest of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, the First Testament, whatever you want to call it, from Genesis 12 on, it's the story of Abraham and his descendants. So it is the story of how God is going to fulfill his promise. All we know as we're reading is that God is going to fulfill his promise through Abraham and his descendants. We don't know who or how. So we keep reading to see how it's going to unfold. The book of Genesis ends when Abraham's grandson, Jacob, and his 12 sons, who become the 12 tribes of Israel, which will later, of course, be replaced. It's not an accident that Jesus has 12 apostles, right? They're stepping into that place. Jesus is the true and better Israel. Jesus is the true and better God's people. I mean, all those things that Jesus is replacing and taking better. So Jacob has 12 sons. One of them, Joseph, is sold into slavery by the other 11, and he ends up in Egypt where he rises up through the ranks and becomes number two to Pharaoh. And when a famine hits the land, all the other 11 and Jacob need to leave the promised land that God gave them, and they go to Egypt. Then in Exodus, we follow with Moses getting the Jews out of slavery, because after a while, a Pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph, and the Jews get put in slavery for 400 years. They cry out, God sends Moses, you got the whole plagues, you got then you got Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments, and then you've got the Jews under Moses' leadership getting to the Jordan River and balking, not crossing in, and spending the next 40 years wandering around the desert. So the book of Deuteronomy, which is the last book in the Pentateuch, which are the five first books that Moses writes, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, we call it the Torah, the law, the end of Deuteronomy, Deutero being second, so it's the second sort of restatement of what's going on in the law. It ends with Moses dying and the people back at the Jordan River, and Joshua is now in charge. All the people that said they weren't going into the promised land have now died, except for Joshua and Caleb, and they're now back at the Jordan River, and it's take two. And so that ends, and then we get the book of Joshua, which is where Joshua is now in charge. He leads them over, you know, through the Jordan River, and then they take the land. The book of Judges follows next, and Judges gives us a several hundred year period during which time the 12 tribes are in the promised land, but they're not doing particularly well. They're not one people. They're sort of a loose confederation of 12 tribes. The repeating line for the book of Judges is that everybody does what is right in their own eyes. But if you read the Bible, and here I mean if you ever read it fast, so lots of people don't read the Bible or don't read it very often. Some people read it, but read it very slow. I'm going to read a verse. I'm going to read a chapter. And that's great. That's great. That's great. We learn a lot by going deep and unpacking words and trying to figure out what's going on there. But But at least occasionally, we've got to read the book fast to actually see the storyline, to see the overarching meta-narrative, to see what is really happening, right? We get trapped in small little stories and cul-de-sacs, and we're mining those for lessons, but we're not seeing the overarching flow of God's salvation history. So if you read the book of Judges fast, what you come away with is not so much that everyone does what's right in their own eyes. What you come away with is that, oh my goodness, it's really, really hard to be prospering materially and to be doing well spiritually. Because there's this calibrated loop that we see. And I actually have a diagram of this, if we can pull that up. So start at the top, sin. We're going to see that this is where the book Judges chapter 6 starts. And sin is going to lead to suffering. So I mentioned the call of Abraham, Genesis chapter 12, and the Abrahamic covenant, the promise, the contract that God enters with the Jews through Abraham. There are a number of other times where there are arrangements, covenants, contracts made between God and his people. The Jews at the time of Judges are living under the Mosaic covenant, the promise, the arrangement with from God with Moses, and it's the law. And part of the promise given to the Jews in the Mosaic covenant is, if you obey, I will bless you. Like, if you follow me, I will bless you. You will prosper. But what happens is they don't. And so they fall into suffering, and suffering leads to slavery. Slavery eventually leads to them calling out to God saying, hey, we're not happy here. We're willing to go back to following you. So they pray, and then God rescues them. And then once things are going well, then they forget about God and they fall back into sin. So as a pastor, I'll just say, when I hear somebody has lost their job, somebody's going through a difficulty, somebody has cancer, whatever, I pray for you and pray for healing and pray that something works out. But I also pray that this opportunity will later prove to be a blessing. And I can pray that with some, I don't want to say joy, but I can pray that with some expectancy. When I hear that people are doing well, like when I hear that somebody just got a promotion or just came into a lot of money or something, you know, just whatever, that's when I actually get worried, because I think, okay, really, really hard for people to be prospering materially and do well spiritually. And when you read the book of Judges, it's one of the things that you see is it just doesn't generally go that way. So Judges chapters 1 through 5, you start this pattern, and there's different judges that God raises up. And just by the way, the judges are not legal people. They are not presiding over a courtroom. Very inconvenient that they get called judges, but whatever. So they have two roles. They are military leaders generally. They unite the 12 tribes to face a common enemy. But then they also have this spiritual prophetic role in which they say, you think your problem is these bad guys that are pillaging? No. That's a symptom of your spiritual state. They're not your real problem. They're a symptom of your problem. And so Jesus is the true and better Abraham who leaves his promise, who leaves his home to go on a journey and then starts a new people. Jesus is the new and better, right? He's the new and better Israel who has the 12 apostles who replace the 12 tribes. Jesus is the new and better judge, right? Who will lead us to victory over evil, and who also instructs us that our issues are spiritual and helps us see that. So all of that is the book of Judges. We're in Judges chapter 6, and I want to begin reading now, Judges chapter 6, beginning with verse 1. So things have been going well, just by backdrop. So the bills have been paid, the kids are behaving, right? Business is prospering, and so they have fallen into sin. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. So the Midianites are bad guys, they're thugs, they're sort of nomadic thugs, they travel around, and they have written in Israel, Palestine, to go there every fall when the crops are in. And they come in to Israel and they just take over and they eat all the food. They take all the food, they take all the, you know, the land, the sheep, they take and steal everything they can. The book just says that their camels are without number, and that they swarm the food like locust. So they come in, there's a lot of them, and they take everything, and what they can't eat and can't immediately carry away, they destroy, right? And the Jews go into hiding. So this is going on for 7 years, and the Jews end up, when they see that the here come the Midianites, they go, they leave the land and they go and they live in caves and they try not to be killed. So after 7 years, they are going to cry out to God. Reading now in verse 7. When the Israelites cried out to God, or cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, he sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians, and I delivered you from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them out before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living, but you have not listened to me." It says, "The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites." So when you thresh wheat, you basically, you're throwing the wheat up into the air so that the wheat, the chaff and the kernel separate, and the wind blows the chaff downwind, and then the kernel, the grain, falls down. So you want to do this, you want to thresh wheat in a windy place, often on top of a hill or someplace like that. So the note here is that Gideon is threshing wheat in a wine press. Okay, with a wine press, you go down someplace low and you stomp all of the wine, all of the grapes, and then you've got it set up so that the juice runs even lower. So what we're being told here is that because he's trying to hide from the Midianites, Gideon is down low trying to thresh wheat. This would not work, okay? There is no wind that's going to help you. So this is a bad idea, not working. And what we have here is Gideon, he's obviously scared of the Midianites. Reading then verse 12. "When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, 'The Lord is with you, mighty warrior.'" Okay, so if there was a laugh track, it would engage right now, because he's not looking like a mighty warrior. He's hiding. Now, a lot is going to happen to Gideon in the next few chapters. So I'll just summarize this story, and then we're going to come back to this passage. So we're going to see, first of all, that God is going to issue a call to Gideon, and he's going to say, "You're a mighty warrior. I need you to go do this." And Gideon is going to respond the same way that Moses responds, Jeremiah responds, that many other people respond, perhaps you. "Really? Here am I. Send him." Like, I am not signing up for this.
You have me confused with somebody else. You have me confused with somebody with ability. You have me confused with somebody, whatever. And Gideon will say, I don't even, like, I'm from the smallest tribe. I'm the least in my family. I can't even call people to lunch. Like, I am not the guy to organize this this big military issue, this mobilize the troops for battle. There's then this situation in which God, there's a sacrifice that takes place, and Gideon will build an altar, and he'll be amazed that he has been in the presence of the Lord. And by the way, the angel of the Lord, that language is a little bit confusing. I actually think that this would be another example of Jesus in his pre-incarnate state making a cameo appearance. So I think that it is Jesus, right, who pre-exists the incarnation as God. I think that it is Jesus who shows up to Abraham. I think it is Jesus who shows up with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fire where there's four instead of three. I mean, I think there's a number of places where Jesus makes these Old Testament appearances. So I think that this is Jesus, the angel of the Lord, that is there. And so you've got a little spiritual event that happens. You then have the get your house in order situation where God, the angel of the Lord, says, okay, I'm commissioning you to go, you know, mobilize the troops to fight the Midianites. But first, you got to clean up your own house. And so Gideon will be instructed that he needs to tear down the altars to Baal. So there's an Asherah pole, this religious pole, in the worship of Baal. Go tear that down, chop it up, use the wood to build a fire, kill your dad's prize ox, kill another ox, and offer them as a sacrifice. You are violating the first and second commandment. If I'm going to use you, you got to clean up your own home first. So Gideon will do that during the night. So he's not going to be brave and do it during the day when anybody knows who it is. And they don't even know when they wake up and they find out that the Asherah pole has been torn down and that these oxen have been slaughtered. Everybody's mad. And when they finally figure out that it's Gideon, they want to put him to death. But he avoids that. But the whole point is he comes at night to do it. So we're not dealing with a person who is feeling the call of God and is ready to move forward. We then have the situation in which he does call everybody together. He issues a call to fight the Midianites, and 32,000 men report for duty. Okay? So this is, I mean, now we've got what seems like some momentum. And this is one of these fun stories to read. There's a lot of action in the book of Judges. There's a lot of action with Gideon. I was a couple weeks ago, I interviewed a Jewish cartoonist, Jordan Gorfinkel, who for 10 years ran the DC Comics franchise, the DC Comics, and for 10 years, he was in charge of the Batman franchise. So big, big, prominent, important, as cartoonists go, an important cartoonist, right? And he has recently come out with a graphic novel on the book of Esther. So he's Jewish, and he brought together a whole team and has come out with this very high-quality, full-color graphic novel on Esther. And I saw it and was fascinated by it. And so I interviewed him. What are you doing? How are you thinking about this? All that. And I asked him because he said, well, he goes, I go, how are sales? He goes, sales are so good that the publisher has just invited me. I just signed a contract to do the entire Old Testament in graphic novel. And I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, he's got a whole team. He doesn't draw. He doesn't even draw anymore. Like, he's up here. He's got, you know, he's got all kinds of people working on this project. And I said, so exactly how are you going to do, I don't know, the book of Numbers, Elijah,
You're going to have some problems, it seems to me, with Song of Solomon. If this is going to be a kid's book, what are you going to do with Proverbs? How do you make a graphic novel out of Psalms? I don't really understand this. I said, there are books, Judges, Ruth, right? I mean, the Exodus, that really work as a graphic novel. But I think you've got problems coming. But anyway, not my problem. I'm not going to worry about it. But Judges has got some really fun, exciting things happening. So he sends out the call. 32,000 people show up. So now it seems like things are going well, but this is where you got the famous, he puts out a fleece. You might have heard this, right? I'm putting out a fleece. I'm trying to figure out God's will. I'm going to put out a fleece, which basically means I'm going to set up some test. So literally, he's got all these people. They're mobilizing to go to battle. And Gideon says, God, let's just confirm everything. I know that, you know, you've showed up and I met with you. I was in your presence and I was overwhelmed. And I know that you have helped me to tear down the altars to Baal and kept me alive. And I know that you've done this and I know you've done that. I know all these things have happened. But I'm going to put out this fleece, like this some wool. And when I wake up in the morning, if the wool is wet, but the ground is dry, then I'm going to say, okay, this is going to work. So he wakes up that next morning, and indeed, the ground is dry, but he can wring water out of the wool. So he then says, you know, let's do it again. The opposite. I'm reading verse 39. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece, but this time make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew. That night God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. Some people will say, I'm putting out a fleece. The point of this is not to say this is how you determine God's will. The point of this is to say Gideon had no courage. Like Gideon is second-guessing himself. Gideon is looking for any way to get out of this. That's the whole point about the fleece. So there's a whole different set of passages we would look to when we're trying to figure out what God's will is. So then the next thing that happens, also sort of famous in the story of Gideon, is that there's two events in which Gideon is told that 32,000 is too many people to take into battle, because if they win, they'll say, we did it. And so the first thing he says is to the 32,000 troops, is he says, if you really don't want to be here, you can go home. And 22,000 people leave. So now he's got 10,000. And God says, yeah, still way too many. So they do this thing about how they get a drink out of a stream. And in the end, he's down to 300. And God says, okay, 300. By the way, 32,000 might have sounded like a lot. There was 135,000 Midianites. So 32,000 was already 4-1. They're now down to 1-450. Right, those are the numbers, those are the odds. And now God says, okay, now this is gonna work. And then you have the battle, and I'm not gonna tell you how the battle turns out because I want you to read it. So I'm circling back now to the passage that I read, because there's a lot in the book of Judges, chapter 6 and 7, that we could mine for spiritual instruction, things about the importance of or the way fear shapes us, the importance of courage, what courage actually is. We could look also at the importance of leadership, because in the book of Judges, what they lack is somebody to sort of call people forward and say, this is what's actually going on, to define reality, right? These are our real problems. So there's a lot of things that we could look at there. What I want you to see is I want you to have a better understanding of Gideon's understanding of Gideon, because Gideon has to understand himself in the context of a bigger story. And that's part of what we're doing in this series. So I'm saying, look, you have to define
your story in light of the story. And so that means you have to take your cues, your instruction, your shaping, framing parameter from God, not from how you're thinking about it necessarily, how you're feeling about it. So, verse 12, when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, again, so this is, you know, Gideon is hiding, and the angel of the Lord, I think, is Jesus, but it's God. God is showing up. He said, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. And the term mighty warrior, some translations say man of valor. So, to his credit, Gideon seems to understand that this is off, that he's no mighty man of valor. I was at a pastor's event this past week, and one of the devotions was, if you're going to lead, you have got to be self-feeding, and you've also got to be self-correcting. Well, this was just for any leader, but they're talking in particular for pastors. But the number one thing you have to be if you're going to be a good leader, and then they were citing a big study in Forbes recently, the number one thing you have to be if you're going to be a good leader is self-aware. You have to understand who you are and have some sense of how other people are perceiving you and what's actually going on, because lots of people are, you know, they're not very self-aware. So it seems as though Gideon has got some self-awareness. Like he's pointing out, and he will go on to point out, that he's no mighty man of valor. Pardon me, my Lord, Gideon replied, but if the Lord is with us, like if you're God and you're with us, why are all these bad things happening? Why are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, didn't the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of the Midianites. The Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and go in the strength that you have and save Israel out of the Midianites' hand. Am I not sending you? So, in response to the question, let's note this, in response to Gideon's question, all these bad things are happening, what are you doing? God says, oh, I'm sending you. Right? You're complaining about injustice. You're complaining about these things going wrong. You're complaining about an ugly, harsh, toxic environment in your world. You're complaining about this. Oh, you're the solution to that problem. I sent you. You're asking me what I'm doing. I'm asking you what you're doing. I'm sending you. Then we get more excuses out of Gideon. Pardon me, my Lord, Gideon replied, but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I'm the least in my family. Da, 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 da. So look, here's where this goes. Gideon is insecure. He lacks courage. He lacks the ability to step forward. What we have to understand is that the money line in this whole passage comes in verse 16, where God says to him, Gideon, I will be with you. Right? This is what you're not seeing in this whole scenario. Like, I will be with you. God didn't say to Gideon, believe in yourself. He didn't say, look deep inside yourself. You've got this. He says, Gideon, you want to understand who you are. You have to start with understanding that I am with you. That is what changes everything. If you're going to define yourself in the context of, you know, your net worth, relationships, a job, you're going to define yourself in terms of your athletic abilities, you're going to define yourself in terms of something else, then that fundamentally is not going to work forever. It's going to break down. You have to understand that I am with you. That's what changes the story. So, there are some who suggest that my job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
I've heard that for 35 years. Your job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Yeah, sort of, not really. My job is to try and help define truth. My job is to try and explain the meta story and help us find our places in what God is doing and has promised to do. So we have to figure out where we fit in God's story. We have to be defined, first of all, not by looking in the mirror, but by looking in the book and by understanding who God is and what he's going to do. So over the course of the next 9 weeks, we're looking at the efforts other people have to sort of locate themselves and define themselves and see, who am I? And by the way, all of this changes when we get to the New Testament. And we now have not just this idea that God is going to celebrate the weak and he's going to work through the weak, who, like Gideon, recognize they don't have the ability to do this, but that the Spirit of God comes to live within us. God is with us. That's what changes every aspect of the story. Let's pray. Lord God, we pause to confess that we often look at the wrong things, worry about the wrong things, ignore the right things. We pause to confess that we are often like Gideon in the sense that we are easily discouraged or fearful, and we don't do the right thing. We confess that we are often not like Gideon in terms of being very self-aware of who we are and what's really going on and what ultimately matters. So help us to hear in your comments to Gideon, marching orders to us as well. Help us to be those who are carrying out your work in this world through your Spirit. Guide and direct us. Amen.